From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. We begin this week with a story of journalistic principle and political dirty work. Emily Stilgiani is an editor at the Burlington Free Press, Vermont's largest daily newspaper. Several weeks ago, she was contacted by the pro-Hillary Clinton super PAC, Correct the Record.
I got an email from Daniel Wessel, who was a spokesperson with them, saying that he had a news tip for me off the record.
The tip was about the governor of Connecticut questioning Bernie Sanders' record on guns, and it wasn't especially explosive, but Correct the Record was determined.
I said, don't tell me, I don't go off the record. If you have something to tell me, I'm going to attach your name to it. And then it switched to, we don't like to criticize Democratic candidates. So if it's a tip for you about Republicans, then we'll go on the record. But if we give you a tip that brings to light something negative about one of the Democratic candidates, we would like our name not to be attached, and you have to seek permission to attach our name. And I said no again. And eventually we got to a point where, so I'll call you when we have something on the record to report to you.
Stilgiani was so shocked by the dirt peddling by a candidate's surrogates that she wrote a story about the episode. Man bites dog, it wasn't. This stuff is classic opposition research, that political dark art of unearthing and leaking any fact likely to damage a rival campaign. For instance, the campaign of 2008 Democratic hopeful John Edwards. Remember his commitment to fight global warming? Probably not. More likely, you remember this.
Beverly Hills hairdresser Joseph Torrenueva has confirmed that he did indeed give Democratic presidential candidate John Edwards two haircuts at $400 apiece.
It talks about the common man, but every time you look, there's John Edwards getting a $400 haircut.
Yes. Well, thank goodness the Associated Press dug deep and reported the important story about John Edwards. This man of the people recently got a $400 haircut.
Except that the AP didn't have to dig that deep. The yummy little quaff drop was dropped by the Barack Obama campaign. And that was before the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United ruling, which, among other things, unleashed super PACs to build opposition research factories. From both sides of the aisle, operations like Correct the Record, American Bridge, and Right to Rise deploy legions of agents armed with iPhones and GoPros to obsessively cover every second of an opposing candidate's public life and to spend hours poring over online footage hoping to find that one slip-up worth political gold.
Obviously, I don't see it as personal destruction because I'm not interested in destroying anyone personally, although I am interested in derailing campaigns.
Alan Huffman is a former journalist who's been an opposition researcher since the early 90s.
If someone destroys themselves in the process of being derailed on their campaign, so be it. I mean, I think the point is not to have somebody who is unhinged leading your country.
Huffman is of an older breed, having spent the last 25 years chasing closet skeletons in courthouses and newspaper morgues. In 2012, he and his partner Michael Rajabian literally wrote the book on the subject, titled We're With Nobody. The book's release corresponded not only with the Citizens United gold rush, but public acceptance of Oppo research. It's not just that the electorate is inured to scandal, Huffman says. We expect it.
It's partly because of social media that has definitely raised the threshold for people's tolerance. Partly goes back to Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky when people were forced to confront things that in polite society would have never been out in the open. And so I think as a general rule, people, well, they've been desensitized. And because so much is put out there that is not accurate, I think there's more interest in finding out how the information is compiled. And this is how it's compiled, you know. It's like two guys in a rented car driving around America going into courthouses and spending their nights in hotel rooms on the internet.
And in the morning checking their rental cars for bombs. Because someone has been shadowing the opposition researchers while they're shadowing the candidate.
Well, you know, it's funny because I know you're referring to an actual episode in which we were followed by these thug-like guys in a pickup truck for several days. And it was a little bit unnerving. You know, we got phone calls, and Michael's wife got phone calls from strangers wanting to know what hotel we were staying at and this sort of thing. When that happens, all it does is tell us that we're on the right trail. Even though it can be unnerving, it's also really inspiring. If somebody has to dispatch thugs to tail you in a pickup truck, then that means that you're getting warm.
There is dirt, and then there is gold. There's ore, and then there is precious metal. And the precious metal of your business is hypocrisy.
Right. You know, the idea to us is, okay, yes, so maybe this guy did something bad. Maybe he, you know, stole a police car when he was in college. But he turned his life around, and now he's a good leader, and he maybe he's even more sympathetic with people who have made mistakes in their lives. But he can talk openly about it because his actions and his words match up. But when you find someone who is espousing one thing and doing another, voters tend to recognize the disparity.
In this or any previous election cycle, is there a revelation that comes out that you, of course, understand to be the fruits of opposition research that you say to yourself, man, I wish I'd done that?
Yeah, it's rarely a silver bullet. But when you see somebody that really gets something that reveals their unfitness to serve, then, yeah, you're a little bit jealous. Because, I mean, that's our whole goal. All the other things that you look at, their tax payment history, their divorce, whatever, their votes, if they're an incumbent, the goal is always to just indicate that this person is a poor choice as a leader. So when somebody comes out with something that sort of checks all the boxes because it's damning in a variety of ways, yeah, you're like, I wish I could have found that. And sometimes you do find it.
Name three.
You know, we found an opponent who, you know, beat up his girlfriend in an airport, and another candidate who's running on a family values platform who is making loans to his own campaign at a time when he's not paying child support. Those sorts of things matter. You know, a lot of times the sort of just down and dirty stuff doesn't really resonate. We never know when we find something whether it's going to resonate with voters.
Do you get cynical about the democratic process? I mean, is there anyone running who isn't just a piece of garbage?
There's like three. Whether you're a journalist or an opposition researcher or any other kind of political operative, when you spend all of your time just trying to find all of the flaws in other people, it does make you cynical because so often you're successful. But every now and then, somebody comes along. You know, like there was a nurse that was running for office. Michael and I, we've talked about this many times, you know, wishing for someone that would just be good, you know, through and through. And that nurse was that person. There was nothing in her background that could be held against her. Her motivations were entirely altruistic. And it was one campaign that we just felt so good about because our report on her was like 5 pages long. I mean, there was nothing bad about her, and she won. And that happens, but I can count on one hand the candidates that we came away from doing the oppo on that I felt completely good with. But, you know, that's just the way it is. You see everybody naked, and most people don't look good that way.
If it's true that everybody has skeletons, that everybody's got some degree of checkered past, when you isolate those out of context, you create a picture which may not have anything whatsoever to do whether this person is fit for office. What does the $400 haircut tell us about John Edwards? It doesn't tell us anything about John Edwards. Now, subsequent things told us a lot about John Edwards, but certainly not a $400 haircut. He's rich and can spend as much for a haircut as he wants. And when you live, as you do, on out-of-context facts, however nominally true, don't they sort of lead inevitably to larger lies?
The way we do our work is all about context. How do these things fit together to illustrate a fitness to lead? The problem is that once we provide that fully contextualized report on the candidate, it goes through all of these different channels. You know, the pollsters are going to look at it. The ad company is going to look at it. Everybody's going to come in, and they're going to pick and choose what matters. And so sometimes even we look on in horror, and you do realize that occasionally you have facilitated something that is not entirely true, even though your whole search was for the truth. But we're just one cog in the wheel.
Alan, cog in the wheel. You realize you've just invoked the Eichmann defense.
Well, I don't know. It's just the truth. I mean, I don't mean it as an excuse. And I mean, we've thought about that many times. I mean, are we a force for good or evil?
I'm just a coca farmer. I just grow the plants. You know, I'm a simple farmer. What happens to these plants thereafter, it's nothing to do with me. I'm just growing coca leaves.
I mean, politics is a dirty business, and we dig dirt, okay? So there's just no getting around that. But the hope is that ultimately the truth will out and the truth will prevail. But, I mean, what are we going to do if it doesn't? I mean, we've moved on to the next campaign.
Let me step back from accusing you of being the moral equivalent of the greatest killer in history.
Thanks.
Come back to present, more mundane reality. In a world of social media and political fabulism, have you been obsoleted? I mean, do your campaigns really need fact-based opposition research if they can just find out where the nerves are and then just make something up to touch them?
So much is available online now that if you have a limited budget for doing research, you're just going to get an intern to basically do Google and Nexus searches, which has really, I think, made a lot of the work that we've done more accessible to people other than skilled researchers. So it's changing, but that's just the nature of the beast. The concern is just how easily is it distorted, and I do see a trend in politics that I find disturbing, and there's no doubt that it is moving away from documentation, and documentation is what we're all about. So I wouldn't say that we're obsolete, and I wouldn't even say that we're endangered, but I would say that we are very aware of the world changing around us. And I say that not only as somebody who makes a livelihood out of it, but somebody who lives in a country that is being ruled by people who come out of these kinds of elections.
Alan, as you and your partner travel the byways of electoral America, sleeping in Best Westerns and eating in Meatin' Threes and haunting courthouses, how often have you come up with a piece of information that is explosive, but you have not reported to the campaign because you just can't?
Never. Honestly, I mean, if we find it, we tell them. You know, we might tell them the danger of using this information, but, you know, if we find a guy has the most sordid history, I mean, we're going to tell him. And if we find that our guy or our woman has something really terrible in their history, we're going to tell him. As Michael mentions in the book, people often ask us, what's the worst thing you've ever found? And then they ask, what's the best thing you've ever found? And it's the same question. And that is the nature of our business. That is the ambiguity about all of this, is that the best is also the worst. And that's politics.
Alan, if I were ever to leave on the media, it would be for one thing only. And that was if I could do a show called How Do You Sleep at Night with Bob Garfield. That's my dream. Will you be my first guest?
I would love to. And my short answer would be I'd usually start out on my left side.
Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was an interesting conversation.
Alan Huffman is a writer and opposition researcher and co-author with Michael Rajabian of the book We're With Nobody, Two Insiders Reveal the Dark Side of American Politics. Coming up, goodbye, Iowa. Hello, New Hampshire. This is On the Media.
Hey, podcast listeners. This is Jesse, one of the producers at OTM, here to say that the January newsletter subscriber hat giveaway is officially over. We've chosen three winners, and their hats are soon to be in the mail. But for the rest of you, thank you so much for subscribing, and welcome to the OTM newsletter family. Anyone else who's hearing this who hasn't subscribed, go to onthemedia.org/newsletter and sign up to get our wonderful newsletter and maybe win some stuff.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, in addition to claiming that Ted Cruz stole his Iowa victory, Donald Trump also accused the Texas senator of delivering a speech so long and rambling that it would be his, quote, Howard Dean moment. Nope. But Dean's infamous shriek in Iowa 12 years ago has persisted as shorthand for a complete campaign disaster. Data News site 538, our collaborators in this election season, are producing a series of documentaries revisiting historic moments from past campaigns. In this excerpt from the first episode, producer Galen Druk explains why the real story of the Dean scream is not how we remember it.
In the weeks leading up to the 2004 Iowa caucuses, polls were predicting that Howard Dean would come in first. And after coming in third, this happened.
And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House! Yeah!
Immediately, the story in the news media and on late-night comedy shows was that his campaign was dead in the water.
Howard Dean's falling far and fast here, and he's got no one to blame but himself.
Oh, my God, did you see Dean's speech last night? Oh, my God. Now I hear the cows in Iowa are afraid of getting mad Dean disease.
We're going to go to Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. We're going to Cancun for spring break.
The I Have a Scream speech was played 633 times in 4 days, according to one analysis. And that's just on the national networks. Soon, Howard Dean and his wife were fielding questions like this from Diane Sawyer.
How often does he lose his temper around you?
I can't remember the last time. He just doesn't get that angry.
Interpretations of the media takedown of Howard Dean filled blog posts, message boards, and opinion pieces all over the internet. And they still do. I found some threads from just last year, and after searching through the 10 years of commentary on the topic, two main lines of thinking emerge. One theory gets at a fundamental question about whether the scream ever really happened as we all heard it. First, remember, that night in Iowa, it was loud. Howard Dean.
I go out, I get on the stage, there's 1,200 kids making so much noise it was like a jet engine in the room.
There were thousands of people in the room.
Dean's communications director, Tricia Enright.
It was deafening. It was so loud. We could hardly hear him. Frankly, all we could hear were the sounds of the people cheering.
Other people who were in the room that night either didn't hear the scream or thought nothing of it. And neither did Dean.
I don't remember doing that the way it came out. I mean, I certainly went, yeah! I'd done that a zillion times. And as I say, none of the print reporters thought much of it, so I assume it was always the same, yeah, that I always did.
So why did the people there, along with Howard Dean himself, hear something so different from what everybody heard at home? This is where we have to get a little technical. I paid a visit to Jennifer Munson. As you all probably know, she's On the Media's technical director. We went into the studio and we sat in front of the mixing board for a lesson in news audio. When we looked at the video of Dean that night, Jen immediately recognized the mic he was holding.
It's a Sennheiser Evolution Series microphone that was commonly used at these events in Iowa.
What does that kind of mic do? What is it used for?
It's very specific for stage use, where that microphone is capturing whoever's speaking into it and not much else.
The sound of just Howard Dean is what we're all familiar with. It's what broadcast over the airwaves. But we want to know what that moment sounded like in the actual room that night. And there are recordings out there from people who were standing on the floor.
This is one of the cheering at the exact time that Howard Dean was making his speech.
You can't hear it, but we promise. Dean is screaming right now.
That's not anything anybody's going to remember from this moment. What we all remember is this.
And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House! Yeah!
So I've taken those two examples and mixed them together to give a more realistic audio representation of what was going on that night.
Michigan! And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House!
Why did everybody at home just hear Howard Dean shrieking?
That, I think, is a combination of the particular microphone that he was using and the fact that the engineer mixing this for broadcast didn't mix the room into the scene. In every instance that I know of, there are multiple microphones being sent to the engineer that go out for broadcast, and one of them comes from the camera, one probably comes from some room mics, and one from this microphone that you see in the image. As the engineer, you're supposed to pull all this together to create a representation of what's going on.
Other than his voice being isolated, the sound that comes out sounds almost like a shriek. It's not a sound that we're used to hearing. Does that have anything to do with the microphone or how he's talking into it?
Normally, anybody holding a microphone, the louder they get, the farther they pull the microphone away from them, because it starts to then overload the microphone. And I can give you an example. I mean, this is me getting louder and louder and louder on this same microphone. And if I were to really hold it and talk to you like this, you get this distortion. And his instinct, because it's so loud in the room, I think, is to just try and be heard over the crowd. And so you see in the picture, the microphone is like right in his mouth.
So what Dean sounded like on TV didn't give us the whole picture. That's one argument of the scream skeptics. But once media outlets had that isolated audio, why did they play it a whopping 633 times? Dean's campaign manager, Joe Trippi, has a theory.
All the party establishment attacks were about he didn't have the temperament to be president, that he was too hot-headed, those kinds of things. And I think the media was sort of handed a gift. Here's a great way we can put the exclamation mark on that narrative that the establishment had been selling.
And that brings us to the other prevailing theory, that the media actively worked against Dean, or even felt threatened by him. In one thread posted on Reddit, someone writes, quote, "I watched the whole thing play out, and it was clear that the news media cut his throat deliberately," end quote. The thinking goes like this. When Howard Dean was the front runner, he went on Hardball with Chris Matthews and said, quote, "We're going to break up the giant media enterprises," end quote. In a blog post at the time, someone wrote that this, quote, "amounted to a declaration of war on the corporations that administer the flow of information in the United States," end quote. It's a big claim. To be clear, we don't have any evidence of that kind of coordinated conspiracy. What we do have, though, are admissions by media members themselves that they got carried away. This is Diane Sawyer, a week and a half after the Iowa caucus.
The president of CBS said, "Individually, we may feel okay about our network, but the cumulative effect for viewers with 24-hour cable coverage is it may have been overplayed and, in fact, a disservice to Dean and the viewers, all of us together." And the head of CNN said, "We've all been wrestling with this. If we had to do it over again, we'd probably pull ourselves back."
So if the media did have it to do over, would the history of the presidency be different? That's not the story the numbers tell. 538's Harry Enten.
His New Hampshire numbers had fallen by 10 percentage points from where they were in November and December, and nationally he had fallen by already 5 percentage points by the time of the Iowa caucus versus where he was at the beginning of January. So his numbers were already falling as we headed into the Iowa caucus.
Howard Dean would rather be remembered not for that cringe-inducing moment in Iowa, but for leveraging the internet and youth activism, which many say laid the groundwork for the 2008 Obama campaign. And if you ask him today, Dean will tell you, even if indirectly, that actually means he won. For On the Media, I'm 538's Galen Druk.
The Howard Dean Scream documentary was edited by Jody Avergan, Chloe Prisinos, and Stephen Jackson. You can hear the entire piece and watch a companion short film at 538.com/DeanScream. So now Iowa has been abandoned for New Hampshire. But for months, reporters have been trekking to the Granite State, longtime locus of the first primary. Officially, the big event is the second Tuesday in March, but state law empowers New Hampshire's Secretary of State to move it up to ensure that it takes place at least 7 days before any, quote, similar election in any other state. The Iowa caucuses don't count. Brooke was visiting New Hampshire Public Radio back in December of 2007. She'd always assumed that Granite Staters, once again subsumed in campaign frenzy, would loathe reporters. She was wrong. In fact, she discovered how passionate they were about their primary, or rather, the primacy of their primary. All the more so because many people, especially Democrats, don't believe New Hampshire should always be first, since its white, rural, relatively affluent citizenry doesn't especially reflect the party's rank and file. Often other states do try to leapfrog over New Hampshire. Back in 2007, it was Michigan, which moved its primary to January 15th. Per state law, New Hampshire responded by moving its to the 8th. Here's Brooke's piece from 2007.
New Hampshire's state emblem is a great stone face carved by nature into a series of cliffs called the Old Man of the Mountain. Wouldn't he, the most literal of Granite Staters, resent being a sideshow in the electoral circus?
I think sometimes even the ones who claim to be annoyed are secretly quite proud of the primary. Hey, Mabel, we may be on with Katie Couric tonight.
Joe McQuaid is the publisher of the Manchester Union Leader.
Do you see Charlie Gibson? He's broadcasting from the top of the Victory parking garage.
What do you think would happen to the state psyche should New Hampshire no longer be first?
Too terrible to contemplate. It's like saying, what would happen if the Old Man of the Mountain fell down? Whoops, wait a minute. He did fall down.
When reporters want the word on the New Hampshire street, it's too cold on the street. In Manchester, they go to eateries like the Merrimack, Pappy's Pizza, and the Red Arrow. I went to all three. At the Merrimack, I met Betsy Gothier. How would you feel if New Hampshire were no longer the first primary and the soap opera moved elsewhere?
No, I wouldn't like that. We like to be first.
Do you think that you're qualified to be first, to speak for the rest of the nation?
Absolutely.
What makes you say that?
We've been doing it for many, many years.
Doesn't necessarily mean you're good at it.
Oh, no, but we are.
At Pappy's Pizza, I asked Joe Lamont if he thought his access to the candidates qualified him to cast a primary vote that has more impact than the primary votes of thousands of other Americans combined.
Oh, yeah. And then some. I know as much as they do, so.
About urban poverty, racial issues, immigration.
Yeah, I think I have a good handle on all of that, yeah.
As somebody who lives in New York, I never reach out and touch any candidate because they don't care what I think and they don't care about my vote. So I think it's unfair that they only care about yours.
Oh, well, move to New Hampshire.
And at the legendary Red Arrow Diner, I asked 18-year-old Joseph David Frank Bora, a.k.a. Joner, and Eric Werkula if they were bothered by all the media attention.
You think we don't need this every once in a while? Come on, we need the self-esteem.
If it wasn't for skiing and maple syrup, no one would come to New Hampshire other than for the primaries.
And the leaves.
The leaves are nice.
Foliage notwithstanding, the people of New Hampshire are political animals.
New Hampshire, as you probably know, has the third largest English-speaking deliberative body in the world.
Manchester Union Leader publisher Joe McQuaid.
I can never remember the other two. I think one is Congress and one may be the British Parliament. We have 400 reps, 24 state senators. If you're not in the legislature in New Hampshire, your uncle is.
One representative for every 3,089 citizens. Apply that same ratio to California, they'd have to elect 12,000.
It was this belief a long time ago that the more people here who could share the government, the better. And so that makes for a different environment.
New Hampshire's Secretary of State, Bill Gardner, sets the date for the primary. It's written into the law that it shall occur a week before every other primary. For Gardner, it's not just state law, it's natural law.
There's a reason why the Kentucky Derby is in Kentucky. There's a reason why the Statue of Liberty is in New York. There are other historic harbors, Baltimore, New Orleans. If they said it's not fair that the Statue of Liberty is always in New York, so we need to tow it to Baltimore for a few years. Let it be rotated. Then we'll tow it to New Orleans and let New Orleans have it for a few years. Well, there's a reason why It's in New York Harbor. And there's a reason why this unique political culture is here and is nowhere else.
That reason has everything to do with history. Robert La Follette, the progressive governor of Wisconsin, created the first primary in 1905 so that the people, rather than the party bosses, could choose the candidates. A lot of states jumped on the bandwagon, but then jumped off again. By the 50s and 60s, even the 70s, only a few states held primaries. What happened?
They'd have one primary, some states maybe two, and then the big shots. The party leaders would go to the legislature and say, look, it's costing a lot of money to have the people do this, and they don't participate in high numbers. Let us have the power back. And so state after state gave the power back. Well, in this state, they said, no, we want to make this decision, and we're going to keep it. Then after we've had it for a half a century, all of a sudden, a state that's bigger and more powerful says they should have it. We just said, no. We never took it from anyone else. We don't think it's right to take it from us, and we're going to protect it. The American dream that any person's son or daughter can someday grow up to be president, there's a place that can happen, and it's here. When Jimmy Carter came here, no one had any idea who he was. But he went from place to place and talked about why he was running and who he was, you know, Jimmy who, and that demonstrated his character. And he ends up winning this primary.
By the time I finally got to New Hampshire Public Radio, I was convinced that preserving the New Hampshire primary was the only way to save American democracy. NHPR executive editor John Greenberg told me I may have OD'd on the state Kool-Aid.
The Kool-Aid is that you think that anybody who has great communication skills and great convictions can come into New Hampshire, meet enough people, and out of whole cloth, generate a presidential campaign just simply by that quintessential contact of aspiring politician and the people. And it doesn't work that way.
He says Jimmy Carter probably couldn't have pulled off his victory today. There's not enough time now between New Hampshire's primary and all the rest to build the necessary momentum.
I mean, for example, John McCain won in New Hampshire in 2000. But because he couldn't convert that quickly enough into a campaign organization with money, with advertising in South Carolina, he died in South Carolina. That's the point at which the New Hampshire myth gets beaten down by reality.
Granite staters are not immune to the power of campaign money, ads, and polls, says Greenberg, but they have built up more resistance than those in other states. And of course, there's that political culture, decades of asking tough questions of presidential contenders face to face.
So over the past 50 years, what has developed in this state is something that can't just simply be replicated elsewhere. Because you say to the people of that state, oh, now you're first.
And that's the conclusion of a Granite Stater who hasn't drunk the Kool-Aid. Now a final word from the man with the recipe, Secretary of State Bill Gardner.
You can come up with all kinds of reasons why it doesn't make sense, that it's this privilege every 4 years and it's not fair that it's the same place. But there are things in life that you have to experience. And this is one of them. Oliver Wendell Holmes once said that an ounce of history is worth a pound of logic.
Gardner says he will move the primary as early as he has to. Yes, even to the 4th of July to preserve it. Eventually, though, even things that seem eternal crumble under constant pressure. The ancient stone face called the Old Man of the Mountain collapsed in 2003. But New Hampshire losing the first primary? I think Gardner will be a lot harder to crack.
Coming up, the life of a journalist whose death became a piece of propaganda. This is On the Media.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. A documentary premiering on HBO this weekend is the latest entry in a sadly growing canon of American books and films about the fallen war correspondent. But the details of this journalist's death, many of us already know far too well.
An online video from ISIS shows a man believed to be James Foley with his head cut off.
The video appears to show the 40-year-old James Foley on his knees in an orange prison jumpsuit with his executioner next to him, holding a knife in his left hand.
Jim, the James Foley story, paints a richer picture of the life of James Foley, one of the first American citizens to be killed by ISIS nearly 2 years after he was abducted in Syria. The film traces his path to journalism, the pull he felt toward conflict zones, his 44-day captivity in Libya in 2011, his return to Syria the next year, and the excruciating toll his 2-year imprisonment by ISIS took on him, his fellow captives, and his large family. Interwoven into the harrowing narrative is Foley's own videography, taken in war-torn Syria, Libya, and elsewhere.
There does seem to be a strong sense that they won't give up the fight, and that there are a force of young fighting men. Although unorganized, there's plenty of will to hold out here.
Directed by Brian Oakes, Jim, the James Foley story, won the Audience Award for U.S. Documentary at the Sundance Film Festival last week. I'm joined by Oakes, as well as Claire Gillis, a journalist who was held hostage with Foley in Libya back in 2011 and is featured in the film. Brian and Claire, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thanks so much, Bob.
I must begin by playing the voice of Jim Foley, as till now, most Americans only knew him on his knees in an orange Guantanamo-style jumpsuit moments before being murdered.
My message to my beloved parents: save me some dignity and don't accept any meager compensation for my death from the same people who effectively hit the last nail in my coffin with their recent aerial campaign in Iraq. I wish I could have the hope of freedom and seeing my family once again, but that ship has sailed. I guess all in all, I wish I wasn't American.
Claire, in the film, you observe that that video moment was the most recognized bit of contemporary history since 9/11. But it wasn't any Jim Foley you recognized. Who was the guy you knew?
I met Jim in Libya in March of 2011. And what immediately impressed me about him was his absolute sense of ease with anybody who he might be talking to. He could meet a rebel on the front lines. He could meet people who were in tears and distraught at the loss of their loved ones. And he was able to form this instant connection. I have to say, also, in a community like freelance journalism, where, you know, you have a lot of competition, you have a lot of chaos, you know, there's a fair bit of anarchy on the ground, you will not find someone who would have ever said a bad word about Jim. He was just so widely liked.
I've known Jim since we were 7 years old. We were first graders together, and we grew up in a small rural town in New Hampshire called Wolfboro. And we had a very Norman Rockwell-esque, if you will, upbringing. And of course, Jim became a little bit more transient. He was a teacher for Teach for America in Arizona, and then went to Chicago and was teaching in the prison systems there. And then went to UMass for writing, and then eventually Medill for journalism school. But of course, the whole time we stayed in contact and were great friends.
The Jim you portray in the movie is a sort of a monk, forsaking his own personal comfort for the sake of his vocation, an angel of empathy and self-sacrifice. As a filmmaker, isn't there some risk attached to that kind of depiction, the risk of hagiography?
I think there's a risk. I mean, I wanted a very honest depiction of Jim. Jim never wanted to be looked at as a saint or a hero. The kind of empathy and the humanitarianism that Jim had was there, and you could see it in the journalism that he was doing. You could see it in his teaching, and so it wasn't that I was trying to search for it or bring it out. It was just apparent.
Some of the most poignant moments in this film are those in which his fellow captors describe their admiration and love.
I think I said to him, you know, you're the most honest person. There is no evil at all to find in you, James. You are pure good, sometimes too good. And I'm really happy that I've met you. That was our Christmas night. When I went to bed that night, I really felt that I had the best Christmas night in my life.
That was Daniel. He's a Danish photojournalist who was in Syria for 2 days before he was taken. Jim was captured a year before he was put into a cell with these other hostages. So in a way, Jim had a lot of experience of being in captivity. They really looked upon him for kind of guidance.
You know, we all identify Jim with the beheading, but that was mercifully brief. The captivity was just beyond horrendous. Claire, can you tell me some of what happens to a person in this situation, which you were in Libya with Jim?
First of all, it's essential to draw a distinction between our Libyan captivity and what Jim and the other captives have gone through with ISIS. In Libya, you know, we were caught in an ambush. It was pretty clear from the beginning that the soldiers knew that they'd made a mistake. Once we got transferred to an actual prison system, it was 3 meals a day, blankets, pillows. It was not anything to be compared to years on end of starvation and torture.
What you do share with the prisoners of Jim's second captivity, however, is utter lack of control over your own fate.
Yes, precisely. Due to the fact that you haven't been able to be in contact with your family and loved ones, you don't know what they know. You don't know if they think that you're dead. We spoke many, many times about this because it's almost worse to imagine the suffering that you're putting someone else through than to live out your daily reality, whatever that happens to be.
Throughout the first half of the movie, Jim's family and colleagues are heard to ask aloud, why go to these places? What is really gained by putting oneself further and further in harm's way? In fact, we hear Jim Foley himself posing the same question.
I tried to question myself, what are you reporting on? What is this all about? It was quickly apparent that this was about being what you think is an authentic conflict correspondent, seeing the front line, and not being enough to just see it from a distance, but to push it to the next level. You were basically waiting to get shelled, and the question is, why?
The number one piece of advice that's always given to journalists that we give each other is, you know, report the story, don't be the story. And when you find yourself too close to the edge, you're forced to ask the question again, why am I here? What am I doing? You know, you're at the border and you see refugees pouring over it, and you want to talk to the refugees. But, you know, me personally and a lot of my colleagues, I want to see it. And you have to be checking with yourself all the time when you might be crossing the line into some kind of ego. Jim was certainly concerned that his ego was making him make decisions that he would later regret.
You said in the film that it was a certain point where you realized that the people who you have been depending on as your sources, your translators, your drivers, your everything, suddenly one day a switch has been thrown and they are no longer looking at you as friends or even as a benign force.
So in the early days of what we think of now as the Arab Spring uprisings, there was a lot of sympathy and interest for Western journalists, especially among people in Libya who'd hardly seen Westerners before, and people in Syria, because they saw what had happened in Libya, that all of us had reported the impending humanitarian catastrophe. We'd reported that the rebels wanted freedom and peace and the right to elect their leader. And of course, what happened in Libya is NATO declared a no-fly zone, and that saved the rebel uprising. Syrians saw that happen, and they anticipated that the same thing would happen. It did not come to pass for a variety of reasons. And after a year, after a year and a half, after 2 years, anybody who's been living with the daily effects of war, their sympathies towards you, what they think that you can do for them, it's going to change. You know, if you are working with a translator who happens to have a cousin or a fiance being held by the regime in Damascus, well, you know, if you have a Western journalist, you can probably trade that to get your own loved one back from Damascus. So the relationship, which had been very symbiotic early on, changed in such a way that you just couldn't necessarily count on people who you'd known for a long time.
Brian, another kind of sickening thread that runs through the film is the either indifference or impotence of the Obama administration in securing information, much less any hope for the captives' release, which you portray in contrast to, for example, the French government.
Our government policy is we do not negotiate. The French and the Spanish, the Italians, their governments negotiate. You know, the Foley family obviously struggled to get Jim released. You know, but I do know as a result of Jim's execution and Diane Foley especially, she's made waves with the Obama administration and they've established a hostage fusion cell. There's nothing we can do to bring Jim back, but Jim was always a positive person, and I think that's the mantra that the Foleys have taken now, and they're doing everything they can to help families who are in similar situations currently.
Brian, one of the most powerful aspects of this film for me was something that was not mentioned in a single frame. Jim and the other 18 captives were held under brutal conditions. Some of them, like Jim, were murdered. Most were released. But there was the colleague who he arrived with, a British journalist named John Cantley, who was not released, but he survived and recorded a series of what can only be called propaganda pieces, offering criticism of the West. You clearly made the decision not to set up the contrast. Why?
I can't actually get into it. You know, I can say that we hope that John has found a way to survive in Syria and that we hope to have him home at some point.
I think making a clear comparison somehow between where he's ended up and where Jim has ended up, there's an implicit judgment there that I don't think anyone is comfortable making, not least because, you know, we always like to think, oh, if such and such happened to me, I would act like this. And if my experience has taught me anything, it doesn't matter what you think you'll do. You have no idea what you're going to do. So his situation is, to us, very unknowable.
Unknowable. For, after all, as we heard in the very beginning of this conversation, even Jim was coerced to say words that clearly he did not believe. And maybe that's in this whole rather touching and frightening tale you tell the nub of the thing. What's universal here is our universal inability to know exactly who we are and what we do.
Jim's last moments in that desert, there's no way we're ever going to know what that surrounding environment was. My choice was to reclaim that moment and take it away from its original purpose. I think when you get to know Jim, you understand what he was doing, you look at that image in a completely new way.
94% of Americans were aware of Jim's execution. The central purpose of this film was to explain why Jim and people like you go to places like Aleppo. And the answer was to show the world what was going on. But the world didn't really pay that much attention until their attention was diverted from the casualties of the Syrian civilians to the casualty of the American journalist there to document it all. It was his death, not his pictures, that made America care.
It is the irony of it all. I'm hoping that the film will bring Jim's stories to the surface Claire and Jim and his colleagues were there 3 years ago telling these stories of the Syrian civilians being bombed by the regime. And now today, we're witnessing the largest refugee crisis since World War II. And if the stories weren't relevant then, they certainly are relevant now.
Claire and Brian, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks for having us.
Claire Gillis is a journalist currently teaching at Dartmouth College. Brian Oakes is the director of Jim, the James Foley Story, which debuts this weekend on HBO. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Mythili Rao. We had more help from Dasha Lizitsina, Alex Friedland, and David Conrad, and our show was edited by Brooke and also executive producer Kathy Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Casey Means and Casey Holford. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be completely back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.